Welcome back to the show, Chef. A couple months ago, I had the opportunity to interview Chef Simon Zichurka, good friend of mine, who also hosts his own podcast called the Culinary Mechanic Podcast. And about a week later, I was on his show recording an episode. And we thought the conversation was so juicy that we decided we were going to drop both of our episodes in each other's feeds. So you get the Mac Daddy bonus. You're going to be able to hear not only Chef Life Radio, but you're also going to listen to the Culinary Mechanic Podcast. If you like what you hear, then by all means, subscribe, like, review the Culinary Mechanic Podcast on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
From kitchen chaos to well-oiled machines, get ready for newfangled technology and old-school know-how. Stories and a good bit of fun. I'm Simon, and this is Culinary Mechanic.
So you want to know the Batman origin story?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. You know, there was a, it's so hokey, because where I lived in Hammond, Indiana, which was right between like Chicago and Gary, my dad was a college professor, and on his breaks and at lunchtime, he would go to a local restaurant, which is called the Big Wheel on Indianapolis Boulevard. Kind of been there forever. And I was always kind of curious of who my dad was out in the public, right? I'd never seen him teach. You know, all I knew about him was like my experience at home, which was, you know, sometimes rocky. So when the opportunity came up for a dishwasher position, I took it. So I started working at the Big Wheel as a dishwasher, hating life, man. I mean, they beat the shit out of those pans. I'd be scrubbing them, trying to get them clean. I think even today, there's probably a stack of 12-inch saute pans stuck up in the popcorn ceiling that I just refused to finish up. But and sometimes I would catch my daddy. He'd sit at the counter, and there was the main cook. Her name was Artelia White. She had a gold tooth in front. She worked the wheel, you know, back in the day when there was a physical wheel. And she would sit there in the window and just kind of chat back and forth with my dad. And he was kind of, you know, chatty up with the waitresses and, oh, Dr. And so I'm kind of just trucking through there. And one Friday night, I'm walking past the kitchen door, and it was right in the middle of service. And the two women, Artelia White and this really, really thin, severe woman who I'd never heard her speak out loud. Artelia was the one that was always barking orders and stuff. But it was just this one weird moment where I turned my head and I saw the two women engaged in this dance where there was pans and steam and food, and they went together and passed. Like, they moved in such a dance that they didn't communicate anything outwardly, but it was so smooth and beautiful in that one moment. And I turned away and I said, I don't know what the hell that is, man, but I got to get me some. So
I tried
doing other things. I sold clothes. I sold Tom McCann shoes, but it just seemed like every time I came back to working in a kitchen. And the first time I got a cook's job was at a Greek restaurant in a mall. And the guy says to me, so you know how to clean beef tenderloins, right? And I said, oh yeah, sure. And the first day there's another dude standing next to me. We got our cutting boards and a stack of, you know, a case of Pismos. And I'm kind of like watching out of the corner of my eye to see how he's doing it. And I'm trying to mimic what he's doing. I think like there was more meat than silver skin in the garbage can at that first one. I mean, I just hacked the shit out of it. But I seemed to learn really, really fast. And the thing that struck me was the sense of community in the kitchen. Like, that's the first thing that really pulled me in, was this kind of idea of the island of misfit toys, where, you know, it didn't matter where you came from, what you did, that as long as you could hold down your station and work hard, you were accepted. And so that's kind of the thing that relational connection to me has been the thing that's always driven my career. I never really thought I had this idea of like a specific type of cuisine that was going to be Adam or, you know, trying to be avant-garde or trying to be ahead of the curve. Although when I moved to South Florida, there were a group of us that were following the Mango Gang, which was, you know, Alan Susser and Norman Van Aken. And we were kind of like the ascendant group of chefs. And so that's when Floridian cuisine was really hot and stuff like that. So got in the middle of that. But it always came down to like the crew, like feeling part of the crew and feeling what that was like to go through, you know, hell and high water through a shift, only to find out at the end that there were no bringbacks. It was a perfect score. And you look around at one another, you go, wow, did we just do that? Because there's always that one moment in this shift, in the peak point where like time compression just comes in, everything slows down, and you feel like right on the edge of everything going sideways. And somehow it's always the team that pulls us through, right? And so I've been motivated by that type of passion and compassion all through my career. And it's been a labor of love. And the industry has given me so much opportunity to learn and to experiment and to be different versions of myself, because I was very focused on becoming the apex predator in the punch bowl. From where I grew up in Hammond, Indiana, I understood that if I wanted to be a chef, I had to kind of hop jobs, Calumet City, South Chicago. If I was going to get up in the city, that's where I could be a chef. And I got as far as Calumet City before I like just was shaking my head. I was a sous chef at a country club, and the executive chef was a woman, and she decided to visit upon me every slight, every ill that she had to suffer. So I was basically the emotional whipping post for the entire group of men. And I learned very, very early on that having the feminine in the kitchen is a really good thing. Like, it provides balance in so many ways. And so my very first executive chef job, my sous chef was a woman, and she saved my ass from getting fired several times. And she said, we had a goodbye for me after a year and a half. And she said to me, Lamb, you know, you weren't a very good chef when you started, but you turned into a pretty good one. And coming from Lori Walker, I took that high praise, man, for sure.
That's good stuff. You know, I listened to that and I just remember somebody I was talking to not too long ago say to me, you know, kitchens in some ways, especially back in the day, were like the last true meritocracy, right? Yep. It's like everything, it doesn't matter if you had it didn't matter if you had green hair or if you had a mohawk, or nowadays it's like you got piercings, you got tattoos, whatever that is, it's like kick ass in the kitchen, you know, and kick ass on your station and keep it clean and you're gold, you know. Talk about like a perfect score. I worked in a steakhouse back, gosh, so that was, in the mid-90s, and it was all wood fire back when it wasn't as popular, right? And instead of being this sort of the more shallow grates, these grates were, they were easily 32 inches deep. So you had long tongs and you were reaching back over fire to get that like well done back in the corner. You know,
you also had a bain marie of ice water to stick your hand in.
Oh yes. Oh yes. And you had the big ingredient bins at your feet with soaked wood. So it was smoky and you couldn't see because you were constantly creating that, like you're trying to temper that fire with a piece of wood so that you get some smoke and really get everything going. And at the end of the night, you know, you'd be if you were on the grill, you'd be clamoring to the chef or to the sous chef to say, how'd I do? Oh, well, you had, because they wouldn't, in the middle of service, you'd never know, because we're just moving too fast, you know. And I'll never forget, I was one day, the grill cook, he had a rough one. And I just looked at the guy standing next to me, and I was the guy who was saucing plates. And remember timbales of rice, right? Packing the rice, a little butter inside that bouillon cup. and I was the guy back in the day plating.
Right, the confetti on the rim. That was back in the day with the timbales.
Oh man, this was one step removed from that, because we had nothing on the plate. There was no garnish. It was a steakhouse. We plated everything in the window, so the plates were lightning hot, and the inside of your forearms were just scars constantly. Yeah. It was years before I got rid of those things. And so I thought I had the easy job, right? I'm the sauce guy. I make sauces. I know how, I learned how to do that. That's cool. And I said to the guy sort of in the middle, you know, he helped plate and everything. I was like, man, I don't know if I could do that. And this son of a bitch turns to the chef at after service and he goes, Simon doesn't think he can grill. So I walk in the next day. It's a Wednesday night. And I shook hands with the chef, said, good afternoon, sir. He said, good afternoon. You're on the grill today. I was like, what? I turn and I look at Tony. I was like, what did you do? Like, you're the only person I said that. He's like, well, I just told him that you didn't think you had it. And so I'd never worked that grill. I'd worked multiple grills throughout the previous 4 or 5, 6 years. And at the end of the night, I turned, I looked, and he goes, if it wasn't for the fact that the other guy would cry every day if he didn't get to be on the grill, I'd put you on the grill because there was less drama and like, right. You just did it. And you were so scared to screw up that you were like a machine. And I was like, thank you. He goes, now get back to your station. I don't know about you, but I did not get into the restaurant business to spend all my time in a cramped little office. I love being in the kitchen, out on the floor. And if you're nodding your head right now, I want to introduce you to an amazing company called Starfish. Look, I've gotten to know their CEO, Jordan, recently, and what they're building really impresses me. They're using AI to read your P&L, and they're going to email you actionable insights every week so you can lower your costs and increase revenue. Best part is you don't have to spend time digging through your P&Ls, poring over reports in that cramped little office. Starfish is going to do that for you, so you can get back to the part of the business that you love. If you're interested, go to their website, usestarfish.com. That's USEstarfish.com. And tell them Simon sent you.
You know, you bring up a great point, man, that, you know, that fear of fucking up, you know, can serve you really, really well, man. Because yeah. Now, like, I think just like anything else, man, once we start getting complacent and comfortable, that's when the trouble starts. But as long as we're like approaching things with a certain amount of, you know, I would replace probably fear with reverence. And I was thinking about our conversation today, and one of the things that kept popping up in my head was this idea of presence, right? Like, what makes a great chef? And we can talk about, you know, leadership and all this other stuff. But I think really what separates the good from the great is this idea of being completely present in the moment, whether they're with, you know, building a dish or whether out with the guests. You know, they're like nothing else exists except for that moment, right? Yeah. Everything's chaos is going all around them, but if they can just be present in that one moment, I had an opportunity to do that during COVID. There was a server who was like on the verge of breakdown, and we were walking back and forth in this hallway, and I just stopped her and I said, "Listen, I just need you to just let it all out. I got you." And people were walking past, and I'm like, "I don't care about them," like. I didn't care about whether service was starting or anything. Like, for me, the most important thing in that moment was being there for her. Like, it didn't end up that we solved anything or that it, you know, that it made her feel any better. But I think in that one moment, she got that I was willing to listen to her, regardless of whether I had a solution for her or not. It was kind of like bringing me back to this idea of like, when we can have that presence in every moment of our day, man, the great day.
Yeah. You know, I think for me, like I had a time in my sous chef career, you know, it was probably 4 or 5 years long where I was this spaz, man. Like things would hit me in the face and I'd be like, oh my God, yeah. You know, like the sky is falling. And I had a chef who he had moments of zen-like clarity. He didn't have a lot of them. Because he was pretty hot, you know, he'd come from one of those cultures, right? Yeah. And I had spent time in the same company, but one of those cultures where it was openly said that, like, if you're brilliant, asshole is tolerated, right? And so the nuclear would come to him pretty fast. Like, he'd be calm, he'd be like, and he was a tall dude, he's probably 6'3". Right? Bald head. He was a swimmer. So he had shoulders wide as Kansas. And he just had a presence. And there was moments where I would just be like, how are you so calm right now? Like, how do you do that? And he, you know, but then he would just rock past that and just go into like the screaming, yelling, like pulling out hair he didn't have. Yeah. And I asked him one day, and he said, Simon, if you are committed to success, you will quickly see that the attitude, the demeanor, the fear, all those things that are on the face of your team is a direct mirror of you. So if you can stay calm, they can stay calm. And I said, how come you can't stay calm? He said, I try. He goes, I really try. He goes, and I know I have some good moments, but I just, shit. And I was like, okay, I got it. And it took me a few years to get past that experience, right? Like just a couple more kitchens. And all of a sudden I had someone say, tonight was kind of crazy. How are you so calm? And I thought, I really think you're right. It's being clear about exactly where you are in that moment and what is best for my, I stopped thinking about myself and I started thinking about my team more and how they were reacting to my spaz or my lack of spaz, you know? Yep. And now I tell people, hey man, I want you to be the eye of the hurricane. I want you to be that calm center where everything around you is just flying out of control, but you're calm and thinking what next steps are so that you can direct that craziness, you know? Sure.
Yeah, because there's a way to harness that energy that's happening all around you and direct it, but never going to be from a point of you being that excited and energetic, right? To drop your knowing and go, okay, so this is where it's going to go and how do I get there? You know, I'll bet any amount of money that night when you were on that grill that first time, you were absolutely present to everything that was going on. Like you knew everything was on, you know, like there was nothing that was going to carry your attention away from that.
Well, and the other part was the guy who was normally on the grill was on my station and he was stuck and he was half coaching, half heckling me. He's like, come on, little boy. Come on, little boy, you can do it. But he was also digging me a little bit here and there, you know? Sure. And so I was determined. I was like, well, I know how to cook steaks. I'm just afraid right now because this is a bigger pond, you know? I mean, and this was a place that was doing, in the 90s, was doing 64-ounce double bone-in rib chops. Those are massive, dude. That's something you make for Sunday dinner. You know?
Yeah, and then the thing about solid wood fuel, man, is that grill's got a life of its own, man. There's the hot spots and the cool spots, and you know it changes with like every log you throw in there. So if you're not like watching everything and like figuring it out constantly, it's a constant evolution of like, where am I going now? What's happening over here? Like, where am I going to move? And so completely different from any other type of fuel. And there is certainly an art. There are a couple restaurants out in California. Like I was out where they filmed the movie, the movie Sideways, the wine movie.
Yep. Remember? That's Ojai. No. Paso Robles.
Lompoc, yep. Buellton, right? There's a couple of restaurants right outside of Buellton that are these huge warehouses that use those huge, I mean, the grate itself is hanging from the ceiling. You can lift it up and lift it down over the grill. Oh, wow. And these three guys just, because there's a glass window there and you can sit and watch these guys work, it's mesmerizing, dude. I mean, it's just like, those guys are worth every penny that they get paid because it comes out the product. And to your point, plates are clean. There's nothing on it. It's just like, here's your beauty right there, man. Fantastic stuff.
Man, that was the space where the filet would sit on the toast round. And if it bled through the toast, if there was blood on the plate, you were replating.
Yeah.
Oh,
I mean, you know, today, how many folks actually know that they gotta let that stuff rest, right? Let it rest before you plate it, please.
I learned those lessons, boy. I learned those lessons, you know, and I, as at the end of my tenure there, I was confident enough in plating that I would look at the chef and go, hey, like for some reason he didn't get those two ribeyes on and now they need to rest. So we're going to do that next ticket. He's like, no, I want that. I'm like, no, chef. Because if I do it, I'm going to do it three times. I'm going to plate it three times instead of just giving you what you want the first time and out. And you know, thankfully the chef and I were pretty good friends, right? And so he learned that I was growing really quickly, and you know, but after like 2 years of that, I was like, okay, I gotta go. That was such an intense environment. I wanted to learn more about food. I think for me, like, those were days when I couldn't get a pan in my hand. I'd walk in and they'd see grill cook, and I was just stuck on the grill. I started lying. Like, what do you do? I'm a saute cook, you know. And the first time I did that was rough, but I learned, you know. I was like, I'm just a little rusty, you know. Right, and then exactly. The cook training me would show me. And I mean, I was in Albuquerque, New Mexico in the 90s. It wasn't exactly a food mecca, you know. Sure. There's a couple places, but man.
If I could just round back to that first experience, work at a Greek restaurant, you know, I learned a lot there. And one of the things that I learned had nothing really to do with cooking, but the owner, about 10:45 every morning would tell me, okay, load up the griddle with liver and onions. And I'm like, what? Now, you got to understand, liver and onions was not on the menu. But he had me do entire, you know, 36-inch griddle with liver and onions right before the doors open. And after a couple of times, I said, well, if this is not on the menu, why are we doing it? He said, did you ever smell it outside in the hallway? And I'm like, no. So then he had me go out into the hallway in this mall, and as I'm walking past, you know, you don't really know if it's liver and onion. Like, all you know is you start salivating. And that's how he would get people to come in to have. And I'll tell you, man, I remembered that 20 years later when I was at a seafood restaurant in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And what I would do is right at the hostess stand, I would put up a little burner with a pot of oil and herbs, you know, rosemary, garlic, and on a slow burn, and have that kind of waft while people walked in. And that's really cool. Like, when you can start exciting those senses. I was reflecting on this the other day as well. I was like, when you're in the kitchen, like, you have to use every single one of your senses. Like, you can't have earbuds in because you got to listen to shit in the pan. You know, you can't, like, every single of yours is heightened, and it becomes developed in such a way that you could see a pan and know that something's not happening right, because you can't hear it or you can't see it in a particular way. And I think a lot of us don't really give ourselves credit for the hypersensitivity that we become accustomed to, like, that is part of what we do, so that when we go out into the real world or the other world to take a job somewhere else, our senses are like, well, what do you want me to do now, man?
Yeah, I mean, when you start to understand that, like, something that sauteing has a higher pitch when it's starting to burn, right? And it took me a while to figure that one out, and I learned it with mushrooms. And so,
oh yeah, the tweak.
So when all of the moisture goes out, basically what happens is when you boil all the moisture out of the mushroom, now it's just frying, right? And it makes a different pop. And when I learned that, I started turning up the heat on mushrooms to listen to them, right? And then, so now I'll be at home, you know, and I'll be cooking, and maybe I'll, like, that's got a few minutes, and I'll walk around the corner into the living room. And now it's like, oh, wait, I can hear that the tone has changed. Time to go back, you know. And the first time I did that, I think in a professional kitchen, somebody looked at me like, how did you do that? I'm like, listen to it. It's going to tell you the story.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
No. You know, so, like, I learned it on a flat top too, because, like, this one cook liked to cook at, like, he was scared of making mistakes. So he would turn the flat top down to like 340, 350. And I'm like, that thing needs to be ripping at like 450.
Yep.
Like, otherwise you don't get the series. Like, no, I overcooked things then.
There's no caramelization. There's no,
I'm like, no, you have to be a better timer then. I said, wait longer to fire things. He's like, what? I'm like, hey man, like slow is smooth. Smooth is fast. Don't equate fast with good. right? You know, it'll come.
Yeah, but to your point, stage it all. Like, Now you've got your protein sitting in front of you, and now you're just waiting for pickup, and then it's bang, go. Instead of like, I see kitchens that employ KDS systems, and they don't split their tickets up by station. So every ticket goes to every station. And what I see happen is the cooks will get ahead of themselves and start firing stuff without really firing it in order to make it come up. And, you see some really crazy stuff on the grill where these guys are just hammering this meat just to get it out in under 15 minutes. When in fact, that's probably an unrealistic expectation for a 16-ounce prime ribeye. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, that is not doing that meat any justice. So there was a place in Fort Lauderdale that same seafood restaurant. I had the only printer as an expo. Nobody else had any tickets, and I had seven stations, and we did 750 to 1,000 covers a night, and we never missed a beat. But you get to be really, really good at calling out stations and pick up. Now, you might need, three busboys behind you to boost trays because it's coming out so fast. But, you're getting to dictate windows and stuff. But you really start to appreciate how long it actually takes to saute a pan of scallops, versus growing a piece of fish. And when that's now, it's time to pick up, because our job is to make sure that food is at the height of perfection, not only from a raw state, but also from a cook state at the time to get it to the table. Because after that, there's declining benefit to, like, now it's sitting in plate. Now the juice is pooling, especially for scallops. So it's a real art form that I think, again, not a lot of people appreciate. And I don't think we give ourselves enough credit for.
Yeah. Adam, I love how when you and I talk, like, you strike such deep things in my brain, and I want to completely shift gears and talk about what you just said, which is, in today's world, and I want anybody who's listening or watching out there to understand that KDS is more prevalent than it ever has been before. Kitchen display system, it's screens instead of tickets, and it's taking away some of the art of expediting. Right? We're seeing more things get split up onto things. And I think that my point that I want to make here is, it needs to be clear in the minds of the proprietors, the owners, the chefs, the dining room managers, that this is a new art, right? This is a new skill. Designing a menu that comes through a KDS system and that is coordinated and comes together is a completely different thing. And I don't think that everybody realizes that when they get their fancy new technology, because everybody's excited about this shit. And I love it. I was a part of a team that converted seven restaurants in 3 months to KDS. Mm-hmm. But the first ones were tough, man. The first one, it was like, oh, okay. And you had to find new ways of doing things, because all of a sudden each cook, like in this place, each cook had only their stuff.
Yep.
Right. Which is the way it should be. We did some things where we audited the menu a little bit, edited the menu a little bit, so that if there was anything that was really long, we were looking for ways that we could, without sacrificing quality, speed up production.
Yep.
And we still had them. We still had, like, beef fajitas and they want them all done. Well, then that it was the responsibility of that cook to scream down to the other side and go, hey, just wait on table 61. I don't know what you're doing, but I'm not there yet. I'll give you five. And at five, everything could go flying forward, but I think it's really important to understand that how technology is changing what we old guys have done for decades, right? It's not the same. It's not the same madness. It's a new madness.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more, Simon. The first thing I guess I want to say is I'm a big proponent of technology, right? I think that there is a place for it in all our operations. And my rule of thumb is if it will provide me more opportunity to be front facing to the guest, then I'll look at that. But if it takes me more time to be in the office, I don't want to know. So to your point about KDS, I think even in the best of times, like when it went from, Expo only having to the printer, now every station has a printer. I think the same thing applies from KDS. I don't think KDS which is an incredibly dynamic system, and to your point, needs some adjustment. I don't think that that means that you go without a fucking expediter. I think the expediter is even more essential then, because all you're doing is letting the cooks know that they've got 12 chicken all day on their station. Right? That's probably the best thing that it does. Now you can look down and you can see one of the problems with KDS is if you have, say, most pantry stations also have their dessert stations incorporated to that. Well, if you've got 3 6-tops and 4 2-tops, and all you've got, you're looking at this window and all you've got is salads and stuff showing, and all of a sudden you've got desserts that pop up. Well, the expectation is the desserts should go out before the 6-top goes out because you don't want that 2-top. So there's that nuance where an expediter can actually be helping the guys going, okay, wait a second. If you scroll, click through your screen, there's one at the bottom. We need to get that out first. So I don't think it's, I think it's a great addendum too, but I think anybody who thinks that they shouldn't have an expediter is missing the point, because again, there's all kinds of garnish, there's all kinds of sauces and stuff that need to happen. And really a high value expo person can take care of a lot of that. And it shouldn't necessarily only be like an assistant manager, front of the house manager, who's doing it because he's got extra time on his hands. This needs to be a position that's very well thought out and valued, because it can make or break a lot of operations.
Yeah.
Just from a food standpoint.
I worked for a company for a while, and it was a short window, but boy, it was a neat one. And they turned the expo into the FQ, which was the food quality specialist. And it was kind of an interesting thing. Sure, wasn't quite a full big corporate move, but they loved it. And then they started looking at the additional labor that we were incurring, because we weren't just bringing in an experienced busboy to do it, right? Like that's what a lot of times happens. You get on the outside and you get an expo, and he's like the best busboy.
Right.
Food runner. And so what we were doing was really taking guys and gals who were line supervisor, junior sous chef, like they were good cooks, right? And I used it as a lever, because I could go and then take that expo position over on when things got deep, and I could send that cook in. I could send that person into the line and go, here, dig them out. Or I could get back behind the line and talk directly to that person and help dig, right?
Well, we used to call that the hammer and the anvil, right? So you've got that one that's a floater on the line, and you're like directing, okay, go down to saute, because we're back. Like, and you're providing assistance to that and leverage in that particular point. And I think that food quality thing, like, what a great benefit. Like, I'm saute cook. I've been getting them shit kicked out of me for 3 weeks straight, and I get to go do expo. I get to do food quality one night. Like, it's an additional benefit you can provide our cooks. And I mean, the implication is that that person knows the food so well that not only their station, but all the stations, they have the critical eye and skill to be able to look at stuff and know if it's right or not. And I think that's a great acknowledgement for somebody who, you know, has been in the trenches and has an opportunity to like just take a breath. And to your point, you know, gets in the weeds, that time compression where everything gets slammed. I opened up a restaurant in a movie theater in Boca Raton, Florida. The very first time a full service restaurant was in a movie theater, 16-inch love seats in these balconies. And there was like 150 seats in the bistro, and then another 150 seats in the back, more formal dining room. And then some other stuff we used to do, the concessions. But every night was like, you got people who've got a place to go. They sit down, they come in late. Okay, my movie starts at 8. Can I get my food? Like, we had to go through that every single night. And I remember quite clearly, man, 7:45 one night on a Saturday, I just let the machine run. I mean, the tickets were just, they were piling up on the floor, because we just needed a minute to regroup. And this is like 10 guys on the line on 5 stations, and they're beating ass. We need 2 expos, 4 food runners, because again, there's a time compression now. And then 20 minutes later, it's dead quiet in the kitchen, and you know it's going to ramp up again. So that opportunity to give everybody a break and a breather, I think, is really important, man.
Oh yeah, the master reset button is key. I learned that from getting crushed at this one seafood restaurant here in Seattle. And what I learned to do was make eye contact with my favorite busboy and go, and I'd make the kind of a like the drinking gesture, and he'd go and grab a full tray of cups for the kitchen and fill them with water, and then he'd let me know that he was there, and he'd come down the, I'd say, okay, come on. And he'd just walk down the line handing out waters, and I would make everybody stop for 30 seconds. And it was usually when we were just getting just destroyed. And the first time that happened, the GM looked at me and she said, "What are you doing? Why are you stopping?" I was like, "Because we're like spinning out. You know, we're in the Chevelle SS just burning our tires, man. We're not going anywhere. Like, everybody's sputtering. Everybody's like stupid right now." So I would make the saute cook just turn off his burners. Like, you take your shit out, like, on the grill, grab a sheet pan, put everything on that sheet pan for 30 seconds. Drink your water all the way down, hand the cup back to Jimmy, and then, okay, are you ready? Sweet. First three tickets, next three tickets, next three tickets. And then that last service would go, and everybody would high five, and we would sure. Slay it, and then get ready for the 9 o'clock rush.
This comes right back to like the underlying theme of the things that we were talking about, like the chef as leader, right? To be able to have that presence of mind and like going, we are on the verge, man. We are the car is tipping over on two wheels right now. And if I don't pull back, not in a crazy way, like not like, oh, damn, I can't, blah, blah, blah. No, just to be able to pull back just for a few moments. And to your point, it just takes a moment to reset, and everybody goes, what? Okay. And then they double down in their effort. But if we're not the ones leading emotionally, because everybody's keying on us, what is he going to lose his shit now? Like, do I need to lose my shit or no? Like, no, dude, we're just going to have a glass of water now. That's all we're going to do.
No. I've since those days, and that was probably 15 years ago, I've realized that it restores humanity.
Sure it does.
It does. It really restores. You stop being that machine or that robot for the business, and you're a cook, and it's hard. You know, and I think that once I learned that, I started teaching it, and I saw it happen a couple times where the sous chef would just be like, get some water, you know, get cups of water, like he was scared to do it. And I saw him do it, and he's like, everybody drink. Like, it was the end of a stupid lunch rush in a really busy downtown, like the Amazon, you know, Amazon is right above us, and like, oh, they were tough, boy. They were demanding folks. But he was like, you know, I remember I showed up, and I was a multi-unit at the time. So I showed up at the end of lunch. He's like, I did the reset thing. He like whispered to me. He's like, I did it. I'm like, how'd it go? He's like, so good. Everybody thanked me, including the expo and the food runners who were confused. They had an opportunity to like clear the window of things that were there and they weren't being pushed and overrun. You know, it's such a weird thing to think that 45 seconds to a minute can do that. But it really, I think it's
listen, when you said it restores humanity, that hit something in my heart, because, you know, I've been that person on the line. And when you start to feel like a machine, like you start off like, yeah, I'm a machine. Yeah, man. But then after a while, man, you're like the fuck, man, I'm not a machine. I'm a goddamn like da, 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 da. And you start to really do that dance of like losing your shit, walking off the line, just like whatever it is. And in those moments, they don't come very often. But when those moments come, to have someone who's going to restore the humanity with a glass of water or a reset or just wait to call tickets for a minute or whatever that is, brings me back to like, no, this is something I do because I love, and restoring my humanity reconnects me to the reason why I love it. Right. Cause like I said, I got into it for the humanity. I got in it for the connection. I got into it for like the bonds that happen under intense pressure, you know, that idea of perturbation where pressure, that's how a piece of coal becomes a piece of, you know, a diamond. But that perturbation can only last so long before there's a release or becomes an explosion. And so to your point, I think that comes from wisdom, that comes from maturity, that comes from experience, comes from being there. And I think it's a perspective that many more people should share.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one for me that really, like, as I've gotten older, I start to realize inciting a little bit of fear and creating a pressure cooker environment only works to a certain point. And I've now started to think about it like the tachometer in my car. There's a red line there. And up to that point, you can create some great stuff, right? Like you can motivate people to go fast and hard. But at some point, like, you hit red line and then it starts to go down. And the reality for me is you can only get people to make great food at that red line for a little while, because at some point, stressed cooks don't make better food. Anxious cooks who are in fear of their job don't make better food. I don't care what anybody says. Like, there's a point. Yes, you can do it. And we've seen it, and it's glamorized on TV sometimes. Our buddy Gordon Ramsay has made a career out of showing that.
Sure. But it's a shtick.
It totally is. Like, I got to be behind the scenes years ago on the set of the second season of Hell's Kitchen, and that guy was instructing people to turn off ovens and turn off AC just to turn up the heat on people.
Right, and exactly.
So that's show, and I think that people need to understand that.
Right.
But there's a breaking point. There's a red line to a human's capacity to do great stuff. Right. Under that much pressure. I think that that's why, you know, people are being nicer and kinder and I think hopefully more focused on standards rather than just greatness. Right. Because it is damaging at some point to people's psyche. And you've talked about it for years. I've talked about it for years, but I think that remembering that we are human beings that are actually like trying to do something that we are passionate and love, right? And I implore people nowadays to ask themselves, so was that fun? Because if it wasn't fun, like, how do we make it fun again?
Right? What's the point of doing it? I mean, I like that. I always stand by this, like, this industry is hard. And that's okay. It just doesn't have to be harsh.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like, the fact that we are held to a higher standard, that we are, you know, asked to do things with our mind and body and spirit that push us outside of our comfort zone, I think serves us overall to understand what resiliency and adaptability might mean in our personal lives as well. Like, it's okay that it's hard. It just doesn't have to be harsh. Right? And that's where it comes from. Like, don't be an asshole. But don't be a doormat either, right? And the only way you can bridge the gap is by leading with standards, period, end of story, because anything else is just leading by personality. And then you're up to whims of whether I feel good or I feel bad. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been joking recently that I want that my first book is going to be, Hey Chef, Don't Be a Dick.
For a while, I've been a series of posts called Don't Be a Dick Like Me.
All right, Chef Adam Lamb.
Thanks,
as usual, the conversation with you and I just goes in wonderful directions. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you coming to play in my little sandbox of the world. Tell us how we find you out there in the ether.
Sure. Well, the podcast is called Chef Life Radio. The website is cheflifecoaching.com, or you can hit me up on LinkedIn. Where I have a presence, and of course on the other sites, but primarily in LinkedIn for sure. DM me if, you know, you listen to the show and you got a kick out of it, please let us know. We're always happy for that. And if you have any questions, you know, you can call me at 828-407-3359.
Thank you, brother. So the rest of you out there, please go leave us a review. 5 stars is amazing. Heard somebody say recently, it's either 5 stars or nothing. Well, I'll take what you give me, but I'd love 5 stars. You can find us on YouTube. You can find us on Apple and Spotify and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for playing. Thanks for coming to see us, and catch you on the flip side.